I was just going to add to that, just with a clinician hat on, that we don't have a magical scan or x-ray that definitively gives a diagnosis or distinguishes between different forms of Parkinsonism, Parkinsonism being the umbrella under which Parkinson's disease, multiple system atrophy, other conditions come. And that's the difficulty, and that's why the aim is that everyone with a diagnosis is followed up on a long-term basis, either by a neurologist, somebody like myself, or another specialist with an interest in Parkinson's, or the Parkinson's nurse team, because we see things evolving over time.
Some of the research that Parkinson's UK is supporting, for example, in Oxford, where I was yesterday, the Oxford Parkinson's Disease Centre, they're following very large groups of people diagnosed with Parkinson's, and they follow them with different types of brain scans and different types of blood samples, etc. And they will learn during this project, which will go on for a couple of decades, are there distinguishing features that we didn't know were distinguishing in some of these samples of brain scans that we can use in the future and say, hey, this doesn't quite look like Parkinson's. So these are very important studies in large groups of people.
We'll go here first, and then we have a question in the front row after.
Patrick, we hear a lot in certain diseases like cancer these days about the advantages of personalised medicine where the specific molecular defects are known. Is an approach like that going to be useful for Parkinson's disease, or because all roads seem to lead to alpha-synuclein, could personalised medicine be less valuable for Parkinson's?
I think this is a great question. It's funny that you say this, because on Friday last week in Grand Rapids, Michigan, we had a visit from Francis Collins, the director of the National Institute of Health. And they just launched, him and Barack Obama jointly launched the Precision Medicine Initiative. It's the same thing as personalized medicine, but they chose a different word. But they're very excited about this. And he gave the example that, you know, it would be crazy if we took everybody who was nearsighted or short-sighted or whatever it's called, and gave them just kind of a random pair of glasses, right? We look carefully with precision at the sort of problems they have with their eyes, and we give these precision-made glasses. So this was the analogy, which I thought was very good. And I think we will be doing that same with Parkinson's. I think that in the future we will learn that, first of all, we have the 5 or 10% that are caused by mutations. They will require a certain type of therapy. If their mutation is one of the genes that is involved with mitochondria, we might focus on energy. If the mutation is related to the alpha-synuclein, we might focus on immunotherapy and get rid of this. Now, for the remaining 90%, my prediction is that 10, 20 years from now, we will talk about Parkinson's disease type 1, type 2, type 3, type 4, type 5. In fact, we're already talking about different types of Parkinson's, but haven't given them labels. So those that progress a little bit more rapidly, that go on to cognitive decline more rapidly, versus those that progress very slowly. So as we get the molecular tools to clearly define who's who, I'm sure we'll go in the precision medicine direction.
Thank you.
A question in the front row.
Has any work or much work been done on the relationship, possible relationship between Parkinsonism and people living through environments of stress and many demands being made upon them in the years preceding the development, which was perhaps enabled to happen because of the genetic makeup or whatever?
That's a great question, and it's frequently debated. In fact, yesterday in Oxford, this question came up. I'm on this scientific advisory board, and they said, you know, we have this incredible cohort. If you dive deep into all the people you're following now for a couple of decades, maybe you can get some life history information about death of a spouse or a child or some other major event, a surgery or something, because anecdotally that has been suggested. When it comes to hard scientific evidence, I would say there isn't any, actually. I don't know if you know of any study that clearly links a major traumatic, life-changing event with increased risk for Parkinson's. But on the other hand, from a theoretical standpoint, it's not unreasonable, because we know that major life-changing events affect our immune system, and we know that one of the things that's involved in Parkinson's is the immune inflammatory system. If it's a bystander or a trigger, we don't know. Some ideas with a constipation, suggests that the disease might be triggered in the gut, and the first event could be changes in alpha-synuclein in the intestinal wall, because there are nerve fibers that take care of our intestinal motility. And that's actually been seen in the last few years, that there is aggregate or aggregated synuclein in intestinal walls, and it might be that those aggregates are transported up to the brain and wreak havoc there as they jump from one cell to another. And this whole thing could start, and now I'm really speculating, but I'm allowed to, it could start with a change in the flora of bacteria in your gut. And there was a scientific paper that came out recently suggesting that people with Parkinson's have a different microbiome. And that's a fancy word for the makeup of the bacteria in your gut. We have trillions of bacteria in our gut, and they're probably very, very important for us in many, many ways. And this might be yet another one.